the Financial Sense Lifetime Income Program. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Hi, everyone. I'm Josh Nunn.
And I'm Crystal.
And I'm Justine.
And you're listening to our first edition of Millennial Mondays, where we explore interesting topics, trends, and key drivers inside one of the world's largest living generations, millennials.
It's estimated that there are about 1.8 billion millennials in the world in 2019, which comes out to roughly one-fourth of the world's population. Today, millennials' generational cohort are more lifestyle-focused than any other previous generation, placing greater value on health and wellness over material goods. In fact, according to Eventbrite data, it's estimated that 78% of millennials would choose to spend more money on a desirable experience over purchasing physical goods.
Today's show is all about an industry that is booming because of drastically changing consumer habits and behavior trends among our generation. Enter the wellness economy. So, what is the wellness economy? It's a lot more than healthy foods and the rise of athleisure. The global wellness economy is a $4.2 trillion industry that's exploding. Wellness is an emerging space that includes industries like fitness, athleisure and apparel, active nutrition, beauty and personal care, corporate wellness, mental wellness, cannabis, sleep, travel, and real estate.
So Josh, is that why you were late to the meeting? Because of your cannabis?
100%.
So, to start off our discussion, I want to turn to Josh to tell us about what's driving the wellness economy and why it's been such a big player.
So, guys, this is going to be a really fun topic to talk about today. What is driving the wellness economy? Well, I think millennials in general are driven ultimately by a desire to be healthier, probably more so than any other generation that we've seen thus far. So, why is that? Well, let's first talk maybe about motivations. This is something that Jim Poplava and I talked about on a show last month called Millennial Mondays, Values, Motivations, and Money Habits. And something that we actually talked about were what motivates the millennial generation. Something very characteristic of millennials is a desire to be part of something bigger than ourselves. We tend to be very ambitious, entrepreneurial-minded, and I think ultimately we want to be the next generation to solve all the issues that we kind of see in the world. Another component of that comes to values. So what do we value as a generation, right? Well, so far there's a lot of evidence out there that we are one of the most educated generations. And I would say that it seems to be that university, for the most part, has taught us to think critically as a generation. And so we oftentimes put a lot of thought into the food we eat, how we take care of our bodies and our minds. And so I think all of that together, being educated about our own psychology and physiology has helped us grow closer in tune with our bodies, and therefore it's given us a greater desire to achieve overall wellness. And then lastly, there's also influencers. So, you know, what is driving the wellness economy? There are a lot of influencers out there that make it easier for us to do so. For example, growing up with technology, I believe, has empowered us to be very independent on our own, but also dependent on our devices, which could be a problem that is an underlying cause of some of the issues that we face as a generation. Now, from a positive perspective, you know, we use many apps and technology to stay healthy, to feel good, and to live independently. So you typically think of Uber, Fitbit, Airbnb, and Twitter. But I think ultimately, apps and technology, those kinds of things, those are huge influencers into our generation, and they've allowed us to explore wellness from all the many facets and aspects available.
And Josh, I completely agree with that. Think about all the technology and the apps that we have today and how it's taken over the wellness economy. How many people actually have an Apple Watch?
I love my Apple Watch. Do you guys use technology wearables?
I definitely use wearables for running and tracking all different kinds of fitness. And it's really fun. You can track, you know, to see what your friends are doing. And so I think that just adds to the whole idea of our sort of social economy. And everyone is following everyone, whether it's on Instagram or Facebook, certainly, but also even in fitness apps.
Yeah. And think about, on your watch, you can actually track all of your activity that you're doing and the calories that you burn, and then you can actually share it with all of your friends who you choose to do so.
It's pretty interesting. I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we could eventually see more and more social media platforms come out that are all about sharing health information with each other, because it's becoming more of a trend to be able to say, hey, guys, check out how healthy I'm being, or check out the workout I just completed, or right. check out the food I just bought.
There's even the app called Strava. They paired with Lululemon in every January of the year, and this app lets you track your runs, walks, any type of like cycling workout, HIIT exercise. It tracks it. You follow your friends. And then if you completed a certain amount of exercise activity in the month of January, you got a discount at the Lululemon store. So, I mean, that's a perfect crossroads of these two companies coming together in the wellness economy.
So let's transition. I want to talk about why the wellness economy is so important. And real quick, I'm curious. This is a question I thought of. What percentage would you say of your, let's just take your after-tax income, right? So you get your paycheck, taxes are taken out, your automatic savings are already taken out. This is your take-home pay. What percentage of your take-home pay would you say that you spend on products and services within the wellness economy?
Right. So we did an actual little study between the three of us, millennials. And at first, Josh assumed that his total estimated expenses in the wellness economy was 35%, and his actual expenses were 35%. Justine estimated that hers was 40%, and hers was 41%. So she's a little healthier than she thought. And then you have myself, Crystal, who I thought it was going to be 40%, and I was actually at 36% less healthy.
Which is interesting, because we calculated it pretty much everything aside from rent and utilities. So this counts for travel, groceries, any type of social activities or entertainment. So it's honestly pretty much everything we spend aside from those like basic expenses. So it counted for flights that we've purchased or any type of like travel, Airbnbs. So it was pretty insightful to do that exercise and see how much money we actually do spend in the wellness economy.
And with respect to all the different segments of the wellness economy, so to remind our listeners what is comprised of the wellness economy, right? We have fitness, athleisure and apparel, active nutrition, beauty and personal care, corporate wellness, mental wellness, cannabis, sleep, and both travel and real estate. So another question for both of you, which one of those segments do you think you spend the most money in? I know for me personally, I probably spend the majority of my global wellness economy expenses probably in the areas of, I would say, athleisure and apparel and, oh gosh, beauty and personal care.
Not cannabis?
Cannabis is something I don't want to disclose on the air, because I'd probably lose my job. But
I know for me, a lot of what that encompassed was travel. I have a lot of friends and family that are kind of across the United States, and so I realized I had spent a lot more on travel than I certainly thought I had. And another one was my grocery spending and like eating out, which we're going to touch on a little bit later. But I definitely take, I think, a lot of care in picking what kinds of food I want to eat. And I love cooking. And so that kind of also was a lot more expensive than I think you realize on a month to month when you look at it at a yearly percentage.
Yeah. And I think for me, it varies between travel and nutrition. Some years I travel far more, and then other years, like this year, I'm not traveling as much. Next year I will be. But so for this year, it's probably nutrition and fitness.
Got it. And so, you know, my reason for asking that question, you guys, is this comes back to my original question I threw out, which is, you know, why is the wellness economy so important? Well, as Justine mentioned previously, the wellness economy is rapidly growing. In fact, the global wellness business reached $4.2 trillion in 2017, just a few years ago, which represents only about 5% of global GDP. However, it's been growing at about a rate of 6.4% annually over the last several years. That's nearly twice as fast as global GDP. And the future looks bright for the global wellness economy. An important aspect of this industry are the wellness consumers. And so if I had to make any kind of assumption, I would say that the majority of wellness consumers are probably the younger generations like ourselves, and maybe Gen Xers as well. There was a recent article on the Financial Times earlier this year that was called The Millennial Moment. And what it looked at were cross trends in aggregate income broken down by generation. And so what the World Data Lab found is they forecasted that global millennial spending power is actually expected to overtake Generation X by 2020, next year. So as the primary consumer generation, millennials are actually set to shape the direction of the world's economy in the years ahead. This is the primary reason why we think the wellness economy is so important for our listeners, for investors, and for anybody interested in this sort of thing to know about. So as we transition, let's talk about fitness for a second. Fitness is obviously one of the key sectors of the global wellness economy, and within that universe, it's actually the fourth largest in the wellness economy, generating about $595 billion a year in revenue. So, Crystal, why is fitness such a significant part of the wellness economy?
So, I think when most people think wellness and they ask themselves the question, how can I start implementing healthy choices? Physical health probably comes quickly to mind. And honestly, it comes back to the main psychological driver behind the wellness economy. Millennials in general seem to advocate for self-betterment more so than any other generation. So that desire to want to be healthier is a big part of fitness. Today, fitness trends among different generations took a little bit of a different look. In 2016, the Health Club Consumer Report found that millennials actually prefer specialized classes, going to work out for the experience at niche studios compared to Gen Xers or baby boomers who are perfectly fine with a normal gym membership. And I believe just a couple of the three most important things about fitness is it benefits you physically, mentally, and emotionally.
So, question, how many of us go to the gym? Very honest question, because I used to have a gym membership, and I won't say where I went to the gym, but I actually canceled it because it wasn't efficient enough for me. I had to drive to the gym, which took 20 minutes. I had to drive back from the gym, which took another 20 minutes. Once I was at the gym, I had to find an available weightlifting place. I found that going to the gym was a lot more effort than actually doing workouts at home, than running around my block, than doing interval training in places where it's a lot more efficient for me to do so. So do you guys have gym memberships?
So I've never had a gym membership. I've always been more of someone who wants to go run outside or practice in a yoga studio. And right now I'm a part of a running club, and I actually have a streaming membership, kind of exactly to what you were saying, from a studio that I loved back when I was in school, and they had great classes, and now they stream their classes. So for a fraction of the price, I get access to all of those classes, and I can do them on my computer whenever and wherever. So it's a lot better for me as well. I don't know that many people, honestly, that still have gym memberships. What about you, Crystal?
So I do have to admit, I do have a gym membership.
Oh my gosh.
I know. I honestly, though, prefer. So I have two different memberships. I have my membership, which everyone in this company knows, my Rush Cycle membership. I am addicted to it. And then I also do have my gym membership as a backup, because for me, if I don't get a workout in, I will not be sane for the rest of the day. It is what keeps me going, and it just makes me feel so good inside. But I have been recently, every day, going to Rush Cycle and going back to the whole niche studios, and you go for that type of experience. For me, Rush Cycle is an experience every single time. And you're in a room with everyone listening to the instructor, and there's music going, and the instructor is always giving you different routines. Somebody's pushing you that entire time to motivate you, and you're in the class with 40 other people who are working just as hard, and it's just such an experience, and it makes you feel so good afterwards. And when you're done, you push yourself to the limit, and then you leave, you just feel so good.
And going to that experience idea too, I know that you love cycling so much that you got me to go to a class with you, and they have different themes. They put different musical artists, you know, against each other. And so even just that idea of creating a unique class at a certain time each day really feeds into that idea that, at least for millennials, that experience is really, really valuable.
Exactly. And today, my spin class, the theme is country versus hip hop. And I am a fan of both, so I will be on playing both sides of the field here.
So I think it's really interesting that you bring up the fact that millennials seem to prefer specialized classes over the traditional gym membership, because it sounds like your rush cycle is pretty specialized.
It is. And, you know, with that specialized manner, it actually is very expensive. For me, justifying, I'm going to throw it out here, but it is $125 a month. And to me, that is a lot of money. Like, I am very good with saving my money and not spending it. But because that experience to me is so important and I enjoy it so much, I would never give it up, and I'm always okay with spending that $125 a month and just making sure that I go frequently and like don't miss a day if I don't have to. But if something comes up, obviously, I either go to the gym, because there is certain times that you have to be able to go to the class. They only have certain time frames, so you have to commit or quit.
Man, now I want to try Rush Cycle.
Yeah. Hey, that's a good plug. There are men in there, so you should come. We can do a company fitness, financial sense, bring all of our listeners and just make it an event.
We'll cycle together.
Yes.
So, Crystal, where do you think the fitness industry is heading?
So, I believe there's a lot of startup companies really coming about, and one that really comes to mind is ClassPass.
Wait, I've heard a lot of stuff about ClassPass. And for those of our listeners that aren't familiar with ClassPass, what is that?
So I know Justine has a membership or has ClassPass and utilizes it.
Yes. So I actually used to have ClassPass. Once I joined my running club, I did not have enough time after work to do a class and run. But I did have ClassPass for a good amount of time, like 6 months or so. And so basically what it is it's rather than getting a class pack or membership to one specific gym or studio, ClassPass is an app that gives you access to any participating studio, gym, and I know even in San Diego, they also have like stand-up paddle boarding and other activities, and they have different tiers of membership. So I think maybe one of the first ones is $20 a month, and you get X amount of credits, and those credits can be used at any studio, and each class is rated with different credits. So if there's a really popular country versus hip-hop class, it might be worth more credits than, say, an easy, like, I don't know, yoga stretching class or something. And it's different for each city, so it takes into account the cost of living in cities, so it might be more expensive in, say, New York City than it would be in a smaller town somewhere else. But it's a great option, especially if you're new to a city, to try out new classes and to kind of jump around from different studios.
So ClassPass kind of sounds like an a la carte, almost subscription, so to speak, to try out different gym memberships. That's really interesting. I've never heard of something like that.
Yeah, and that was when I was reading about ClassPass and getting more information on it. That was the whole main point, is to actually fill in these extra spots in these studios, these niche studios, so that way people can really learn and gravitate towards what they really want to do or find that hobby. And I think it's perfect for us millennials, because we're maybe committing to $125 a month at Rush Cycle and you don't even know if you're going to like it. Mm-hmm. Having that ClassPass option and having all these different places to go to find what you love doing is nice for us.
Yeah.
Where else do you think the fitness industry is headed?
Department stores have been struggling as of lately. And so I read a recent article that basically stated that they're going to start putting gyms into these big retail stores, which I think is going to be very interesting. I think seeing a gym there and then going shopping right afterwards, I don't know how that's going to work out. But I think
it would
get people more into those retail areas and retail stores. And I think that will really prop up the market again to actually maybe not shop as much online.
That's interesting. I also read an interesting article recently that these things called smart cities, which were a idea developed by some startup companies over in Silicon Valley, they want to incorporate fitness centers into our built environments. So what does that look like? They're talking about converting like American gas stations into fitness and wellness centers that generate energy. Very futuristic sort of sounding kind of stuff. So as we transition, it kind of seems like our generation specifically has made significant progress towards healthy diets and lifestyle choices. However, I think there's new research that shows that millennials may actually not be as healthy as people think. The Blue Cross Blue Shield Health Index looked at the top 10 health conditions impacting millennials and its trend over time from 2014 to 2017. And while 83% of millennials considered themselves in good health, what the study found is that millennials actually had the highest tendencies of having depression, hyperactivity, substance use disorder or addiction, high blood pressure, and even type 2 diabetes. So rather than previous generations where physical health concerns were actually more prominent. Today, that's actually been flipped on its head, where behavioral health conditions that affect mental health and emotional well-being are actually more prominent among the world's younger generation. So this kind of transitions into our next segment. Another major sector of the wellness economy is the $702 billion nutrition industry, which is actually the second largest in terms of annual revenue within the wellness economy, according to the Global Wellness Institute. I love talking about food, but my stomach aside, why is the nutrition industry so significant to the wellness economy?
And I think something really important to note with that study is, especially with our generation, it's much more common to actually be diagnosed to have depression and other such illnesses. I think that that was not nearly as common or even as talked about for the past generation. So while it may seem like millennials have much higher tendency of having these different illnesses, I do think it's something that's just more widely talked about and more people are being diagnosed with that. So nutrition is definitely a driving force behind the burgeoning wellness economy, as Josh said. And as Crystal pointed out, millennials tend to care more about fitness and overall health, and that does not stop when they leave the gym. So a report from the U.S. Department of Agriculture found that millennial households are buying more unprocessed food and gravitate toward more fruits and vegetables. This falls in line with trends saying that millennials want their food quick, easy, fresh, organic, and non-processed. And 55% of millennials in one study said that convenience is one of the most important factors when deciding what food to buy. And so this preference is creating an inroads for meal kit delivery services like Blue Apron and grocery delivery services like Amazon Fresh and Instacart. And millennials spend more on ready-to-eat foods than any other generation.
Hmm. Well, so that brings up an interesting question. So on a given week, what percentage would you say of your food is store-bought versus going out?
Yeah, so for me, I do not go out to eat. Everything is store-bought for me because I, one, prefer to spend the money on other things like Rush. And and it's much cheaper to just buy your food and make it yourself, but that's just me personally.
Yeah, I definitely would say I spend majority of my money as well on store-bought food. Like I mentioned earlier, I really like cooking and finding new recipes, but with that, to me, an experience is also dining out. So I would say going to nicer restaurants with friends or something that's like a new, different type of food, probably I would say maybe once a week I do that on the weekends, but I never buy my lunch out. I always bring a lunch. So I think that probably, I don't know, 80% of my food would definitely be store-bought.
Actually, I was thinking more during the week, but if it is the weekend, that is the one time where I will splurge and go out with my friends.
Yeah, what about you, Josh?
Yeah, it's really interesting. I would say during the week, it probably looks a little bit different. I would say most of my lunches, I probably spend actually not eating in the office. I typically go out and get something to eat for lunch. But for dinners, I would say it's mostly store-bought. So I would say on a week-to-week basis, it's probably 50-50 as far as ratio from store-bought food to going out.
And I think that falls in line with what all of this research is showing. Another study from Statista showed that U.S. online grocery sales are expected to grow nearly $30 billion by 2021. So that goes back to the idea of things that are quick and easy to make, but that are also healthy. Forbes rated Instacart the number one most promising company in America, and Instacart is currently valued at over $4 billion. Hmm. And so Instacart is a company where you can order your groceries online, and then it's delivered to your door in a matter of hours. There are also meal kit companies for just about any diet or food preference you have. You can do Purple Carrot for plant-based meals, or there's one called Sunbasket, which is all organically sourced produce. Meal kit companies are a $2.2 billion industry, and they're expected to grow 25 to 30% annually in the next 5 years. Hmm. And I don't personally use these services, but I can easily see the appeal. And I have plenty of friends who swear by meal kits as it takes all the guessing out of what they have to make for dinner each night. I even have a friend whose family uses a grocery delivery service for their grandparents as it's easier to get them food delivered right to their house. Do you guys use any of these services?
So I've used Blue Apron before. It is really convenient and really easy to use. It comes with three meals, and each meal serves two people. They individually package everything, so it cuts out that prep time. But I ultimately don't use it all the time. There is a significant kind of cost to that. And I do like to cook myself, but I have used it, and it is really convenient and very nice. Saves a lot of time.
So I have to say, I'm probably one of the few people who have never tried a service like Uber Eats or like grocery delivery. Never really tried any of those things, even Blue Apron. I know my grandparents got into Blue Apron for a little while. But I see the appeal. I've just never been one of those people that's ended up pulling the trigger on it.
It's funny that we both have experiences of people's grandparents who enjoy using these products. So it's not just millennials in the wellness economy. These companies all provide something more important to millennials than money, their free time. And as a generation, I think it's one of the most important threads we're weaving throughout the podcast is that as a generation, our time and how we spend it is extremely valuable to us. And so that doesn't mean millennials don't want anything to do with food in their free time. In fact, it's quite the opposite. Another analysis of historical food spending habits by the University of Arkansas found that eating out has increased from 25.9% of consumers to a current record of 43.5%. Hmm. So to be sure that, you know, this isn't driven just by millennials and this was over a historical period. So a lot of that increase can be traced back to women going back to work and the rise of just fast food in general. Do you guys go out to eat like late night food or fast food at all? Or have you kind of migrated away from doing the fast food?
So I'll develop that question even further. So let's say that, you know, you both are out at the town this weekend and you're having drinks with friends and enjoying a good time. And it's that time of the night where you want to indulge. You're about to go home. Favorite late night dinner or fast food place? Go.
Oh, I'd have to say the one time I will eat fast food, it is never during the week. It's never. But if it's a night out on the town, that is when I would have to say Albert Tacos is a huge huge deal. You know, the carne asada fries or a burrito, my go-to.
Yes, that's true. I pretty much don't eat late night foods or fast food. I think I'm definitely an anomaly, though. Like, I never grew up eating fast food. It's just not my thing, but I don't know. I love popcorn as a late night snack, but I pretty much make that when I get home. So I'm not a good person to ask this question to. What about you, Josh?
I think I'm just your typical Cali boy because I would just kill a 3x3 burger from In-N-Out any day of the week. So, yep, that's my answer.
I think that does prove a good point, is that for the most part, fast food isn't as common with millennials anymore. And I think some of the health issues Josh mentioned that face a lot of millennials stem from different thoughts around food when we and most millennials were growing up. In this era, fast food and processed food still reign supreme. This led to the rise of type 2 diabetes and other health-related issues, especially in areas where access to fresh fruits and vegetables were more limited. And I think this is part of the driving force behind why so many millennials today have an increased awareness around what they're eating and scrutiny on the foods we're eating and where they come from. So many of us were teenagers and even in middle school when documentaries like Super Size Me and Food Inc. first aired. And those basically kind of exposed the dark side to processed foods, to the meat industry, to any type of fast food. And so this, I think, was brought even to a higher national prominence when First Lady Michelle Obama started her initiative, Let's Move. And it was Let's Move, America's Move to Raise a Healthier Generation of Kids. And I think that in combination with these documentaries definitely created an increase of people being more aware of what they're eating. I certainly remember a lot of people deciding to be vegetarian or vegan or just change the way they eat after seeing those documentaries. Do you guys remember that at all?
Oh, absolutely. I remember the first time I saw Super Size Me was my sophomore year of high school. And honestly, watching that film did change the way that I view the meat industry. I mean, not to say that all of that is propaganda, because I believe there's a lot of truth to some of those documentaries. I think, especially for a lot of my colleagues going to school at the time, it changed their way of thinking because it brought to light just some of the harsh realities that we may never have known about. And so, you know, from knowing and having access to that information, we then have that information to make better decisions for our bodies, for our minds going forward. So I totally agree. I think that documentaries like those, they have created a completely different experience and perspective about how food is processed and why it's important to know where our food comes from.
Yeah, and I completely agree. I remember when my dad found out about the movie Super Size Me, and he had our entire family sit around and watch the entire thing. And that really changed my outlook on all fast food. It wasn't just McDonald's. It was all of it. Like, I immediately became disgusted with what it could do to somebody. I mean, they are taking it to extremes with, I mean, the only thing that he was eating was McDonald's. And I understand that can be bad. But it just, the things that it did to him physically and how he felt and emotionally, it's just, it's not worth it. I just would never want to do that to myself.
Yeah, I think it just gave people the idea that, okay, wait, maybe this isn't the best thing to be doing, and you can feel a lot better when you do switch the way you eat. And I think there's also such a privilege in being able to choose what foods we do and don't eat. And to be fair, like, all of these are generalizations that we're making in this podcast, and these trends certainly don't apply to all millennials. And I think we're speaking specifically to the demographic of millennials who've attended college, who do have some discretionary income and tend to live in more urban areas. So I do want to address that these preferences certainly don't apply to everyone and not to all millennials. But as we discussed earlier, millennials tend to favor experiences and purchases over tangible objects or things. And this is extremely popular with what Crystal described in the fitness industry, and the same can be said when it comes to dining out. I think everyone's heard millennials and how they're always talking about brunch, and they've transformed brunch from a mid-morning meal to an entire day's activity, and even from a noun to a verb. People say they are brunching now, and the Washington Post reported that Google searches for the word brunch have been increasing since 2004. Crystal and I are even attending a brunch for one of our co-workers this weekend, so we are certainly to blame for part of that. But I think brunch is an easy example to use, as it demonstrates the greater trend that millennials do gravitate toward experiences, and eating out is just that. It provides the opportunity to meet friends, try new foods, and experience new cultures, and restaurants have definitely taken note of this. Pop-up dinners tend to be ticketed events that last for a finite amount of time, and they're becoming more and more prevalent because you're paying for an experience just as much as you are the food.
So, question, have you guys ever tried, I don't know the term of the actual restaurant, but it's the restaurant where everything is pitch black and you have to eat dinner in complete darkness with your date or your spouse?
I remember you talking about this, and it sounds like a silent disco kind of thing, where you're not, silent discos, you have headphones on and you're listening to music, but there's no music actually playing.
I'll tell you what though, I have a strange desire to try it.
You know, what I really hope is that there are no knives involved in a dark room.
Well, I was actually listening to the radio the other morning, and there was a story on Marketplace about a pop-up dinner in LA from an established Japanese restaurant called Yamashiru, and it was housed in a shipping container, and it served up neon ramen. And if you look at the photos, I mean, it looks like the noodles are actually glowing. Diners paid $83 to stand at a counter and $158 for a sit-down meal that lasted 30 minutes and included glowing cocktails and dessert. It was a ticketed experience, and the first 3 weeks were entirely sold out.
Wow.
Yeah. Clearly, this is a bit of an outlier and wouldn't be nearly as successful in many other U.S. cities, but I think it drives our point home that our generation cares about what we're eating, and we value that experience just as much.
Very interesting. So in closing, the wellness economy is massive, and the fact of the matter is it isn't going away anytime soon. It's clear that there's a lot of opportunity in this industry for both entrepreneurs who are looking to start a business and investors. So for those of you that don't know, Crystal, you're an associate wealth manager and financial planner here with Financial Sense. How can listeners get in touch with you?
If anyone wanted to get in touch with me, they can always call in to Financial Sense. Our toll-free number is 888-486-3939, and I'm happy to talk with anyone that calls in. Fitness and nutrition and the wellness economy is a big part of my life, and I really enjoy it. So if you ever want to talk, or if you want to talk about investments, I can help you out there too.
She's the woman. And Justine, you're also an integral part of our marketing team here at Financial Sense. If listeners wanted to get in touch with you, how could they do so?
They can email me at justine.hall, which is H-A-L-L, at financialsense.com. And whether you know it or not, I'm editing a lot of the podcasts that you're listening to every week. So I would love to hear from anyone with thoughts about the wellness economy, the podcast, or anything else. And Josh, you are also an associate wealth manager here, and you also work in financial planning. So how can someone get in contact with you if they'd like to?
Yes. If you'd like to talk to me about investing, financial planning, or the wellness economy, feel free to reach out to me. My email is josh.nunn, N-U-N-N, at financialsense.com. Or feel free to call our office at 888-486-3939. We'd love to speak with you. So, Justine, give us a heads up about what new shows are coming up in the future.
So, next week, you can look forward to hearing some more Millennial Mondays. We'll be doing a two-part series. Josh and Crystal are going to be doing a Dear Graduate episode with all different advice, tips, tricks for anyone who's just starting out. So, a great show to share with your friends, grandkids, children. And then Crystal and I will also be doing another show exploring other facets of being a millennial and how that's affecting the economy.
Thanks, Justine. With that in mind, we're out of time. Until Millennial Mondays return, we hope you have a fantastic week.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.